Acts 21:15-23:8, the 68th talk in a series on the Book of Acts, was presented by Jack Crabtree on February 10, 2002, at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2002. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved. A brief break occurs in the middle of the following recording. It is the result of the original audio tape switching to the second side.
We are still in the Book of Acts, in chapter 22, verse 17, is where we'll Wait. Is that right? No, we're in verse 21, chapter 21, verse 17. I'm going to need a little bit of help here for the rest of Acts, I think, because as I look at the ending of this thing, what has been a very good movie with a lot of character development ends up being one of those action films for the rest of the book. There's a lot of action, but not a lot of character development. So There's not going to be a lot more that we can glean from theological discussion or insight into the people and the actors particularly, I don't think. So I'm not sure if I can see everything that there is to see here. So as we go through this, I'm going to go through the history of this and try to make clear what the account is. But if maybe you could pay attention to what you see to be some significant insights into our faith, you may very well catch something that I have been blind to, so I could use your help. I'll start with 21, verse 17. Remember, he's just arrived in Caesarea, and for the last time, God has sent a prophet to him, Ananias, somebody we've met before, who tells him that he's going to end up bound and in chains in Jerusalem. And Paul says, I know that. God's been telling me all along, but I'm going anyway because this is a mission I have to complete. Actually, not 17. I'm going to start with 15. After these days, we got ready and started on our way up to Jerusalem. Some of the disciples from Caesarea also came with us, taking us to Mnason of Cyprus, a disciple of long standing with whom we were to lodge. It's not explicit that he lives in Jerusalem, but it would appear that Mnason of Cyprus, lives in Jerusalem. He's a Cypriot. Remember, Barnabas was from Cyprus. Remember also early in the Book of Acts, it was the Cypriots who were the first to take the gospel to the Gentiles. Something about the cosmopolitan culture that they were from were not as put off and not quite as prejudiced against the Gentiles as Jews in other places. Why is he in Jerusalem? I don't know. But he evidently has taken up lodging there. He's a disciple of long standing, or from the first is the idea in the Greek, I think. So probably the day of Pentecost or shortly after that, he's become a believer. And he's taken up residence in Jerusalem, seems to be a well-respected man. But he's not going to be put off by Gentiles who are part of Paul's company, and that may very well be why they lodge at his house. After we arrived in Jerusalem, the brethren received us gladly, and the following day Paul went in with us to James, and all the elders were present. Notice that there's no mention of any of the other apostles here, James and the elders. The tradition has it that the apostles spread to various parts of the world. That seems very possible, very plausible, very likely to me, especially in view of the fact that they disappear from this account in Acts. It would be fun one day to find out what their adventures were. But they meet with James, and all the elders were present. After he had greeted them, he began to relate one by one the things which God had done among the Gentiles through his ministry. And when they heard it, they began glorifying God and said to him, you see, brother, how many thousands there are among the Jews of those who have believed, and they are all zealous for the law. And they have been told about you that you are teaching all the Jews who are among the Gentiles to forsake Moses, telling them not to circumcise their children, nor to walk according to the customs. What then is to be done? They will certainly hear that you have come. Therefore, do this that we tell you. We have four men who are under a vow. Take them and purify yourself along with them and pay their expenses so that they may shave their heads. And all will know that there is nothing to the things which they have been told about you, but that you yourself also walk orderly, keeping the law. But concerning the Gentiles who have believed, we wrote, having decided that they should abstain from meat sacrificed to idols and from blood and from what is strangled and from fornication. Then Paul took the men, and the next day, purifying himself along with them, went into the temple, giving notice of the completion of the days of purification until the sacrifice was offered for each one of them. Okay, Paul tells of his adventures among the Gentiles, to which he gets apparently a very positive response from James and the elders. But James and the elders are concerned. They're concerned that they know the reputation that Paul has in Jerusalem. And the reputation that Paul has in Jerusalem is an inaccurate distortion of who he was, what he was, what his mission was, what he was about. The message that had come to Jerusalem is that Paul was actually teaching Jews to forsake their Judaism. Well, that wasn't true. There's no truth in that at all. But you can understand that if you look at what Paul is saying through a certain set of lenses, namely the familiarity with Judaism as such and your own convictions as Jews, yes, he's putting Judaism in a different perspective. He puts it in the perspective that Judaism was something that God was doing to a particular group of people, but it's not ultimately what God is doing with mankind. And indeed, when you look at what God is ultimately doing among mankind and what he's ultimately going to give to mankind, that eternal blessing that God has to give a human being is the same for Jew and Gentile alike. And there is no distinction. Teaching that there is no distinction in that regard went against the popular conception of the significance of their faith. It just went against that. What we might, as sort of dispassionate observers of the scene, what we might and are able to do to stand back away from that and recognize that Paul is just clarifying some things. Paul just has a more accurate, more nuanced understanding of God's purposes. They perceived as an out-and-out affront to their faith, as an attack against their faith. And once you are oriented psychologically and emotionally in a particular way, reason doesn't really count for much. Someone coming along and clarifying the issues, well, I wasn't really saying that, as we will see in this account, none of that really counts for much. If you decide you're being attacked by someone and you're going to defend yourself against that attack, then you're not going to understand the other person. You're not even going to attempt to understand the other person because you're afraid of them. You're threatened by them, and you're just going to defend yourself against them. Well, that's been the response in Jerusalem, and apparently even within the believing community. Because James seems to be talking about Jews in Jerusalem who have believed that Jesus is the Messiah. Are they authentic believers or not authentic believers? Well, if the rest of the New Testament record is of any relevance or help here, some of them were and some of them weren't. Thousands of them, it actually literally says tens of thousands in the Greek, but the reason they translate it thousands is there are barely tens of thousands of people who regularly populated Jerusalem, so that doesn't seem to be, that seems to be a literary device. There are just a gazillion Jews, is what he's saying, a gazillion Jews in Jerusalem who have believed. And so it must have been an extensive movement of Jews identifying with this community of people who believed that Jesus was the Messiah. Some of them were legitimately children of God. Many of them probably were not. But in that community of people who identified Jesus as the Messiah, many of them were angry with Paul, or at least wary of Paul. And James is concerned about that. So he says, we have a suggestion. We have four young men here who have taken a vow. Now, remember when Paul was leaving Corinth, he was completing a vow that he had made, and he went to Caesarea, and the text just simply says he had his head shaved in Caesarea. That was because usually a Nazirite vow, there may have been other vows, but certainly at the end of a Nazirite vow, one of the things that you did in the Nazirite vow is you swore not to cut your hair until such and such happened. That's what I was doing in the 60s. It was a Nazirite vow. You swore not to cut your hair until the completion of this thing, and then at the end of that vow, in certain circumstances, you shaved your head, cut that hair, and even offered that hair on the altar. That apparently is what these four young men have done. Now, why James' suggestion here? The Nazirite vow is completely voluntary. The Old Testament law makes it clear that if you take a vow, take it seriously, but no one, no how, is ever under obligation to make any vow. It's completely and totally voluntary. So there's a sense in which, since there's no requirement to take the vow, to be involved in the practice of a Nazirite vow at any level is pretty deep into the traditions and the religion and the faith of the people of Israel. You're going deep. And I think what James is saying is, you could put a lie to all the rumors and all the scandalous distortion about you that's circulating in Jerusalem. You could put a lie to that if you would simply be a participant in these men's vow. Because one of the ways of showing your piety was to actually pay the costs of all the offerings that were required at the completion of your vow. I mean, there were lambs and stuff that you were supposed to offer, which could be costly. And one act of piety is to fund the offerings that need to be made by people taking the Nazirite vow, and that's what James is suggesting that Paul does. Apparently, this is a bit of a long, drawn-out process. You go into the temple on the first day at the completion of the vow, and you do a few things, and then you come back a number of days for apparently 7 days until you have completed all the offerings and everything that there is to do to have completed the vow. So apparently what Paul does is he begins the process of going to the temple with these men and doing what needs to be done, but before the 7 days can be complete, all hell breaks loose. Let me see, is there anything else in here before we go on? I'll come back to this, but I want you to notice how Jewish these believers in Jerusalem are. They are very, very Jewish at this point, so we'll come back to that. I just will mention in 25, but concerning the Gentiles who have believed, we wrote, having decided that they should abstain from meat sacrificed to idols and from blood and from what is strangled and from fornication. Remember, that was the decision that came out of the council at Jerusalem in, what was it, 15, chapter 15, something like that, 17, I don't know what it was. And that decision three of them have to do with what these Gentiles eat, what they feel the freedom to eat. Because the Jews had some scruples about what was and what was not appropriate, and the apostles decided that these three things are outlandish and outrageous enough, they outrage the Jews enough, that you're really going to stop their ears to what you're saying if they see you eating these things. Meat sacrificed to idols, meat with the blood still in it, apparently, or which I think maybe comes to the same thing, animals that have just been strangled without the blood having been drained. And then he says, and from fornication. And remember, we talked about this. It seems to me in all likelihood that what he's not talking about the moral sin of fornication, because these things that the apostles have given them are burdens that by all rights no human being would really have to bear. But they're asking them to bear them unnecessarily for the sake of the Jewish people. Well, it's not the perspective of Paul, it's not the perspective of the apostles, that a human being just ought not to be saddled with marital fidelity. I mean, that's not their perspective. their perspective is that marital fidelity is a good thing, a right thing, a freeing thing, not something that enslaves. So he must mean something different by fornication here. And the suggestion that makes the most sense to me is that the word fornication was used by the rabbis to define what they call, what do they call it, limits, the limits of marriage. That is, you can't marry a brother or sister, or you can't marry a cousin, maybe, or you can't marry a... What degree of relation can someone marry and still not be doing something immoral? Well, the Jewish law and the Jewish tradition had a much broader set of boundaries of who you could not marry, of how close a relative could be, and they were off limits to marriage than the Greeks did. The Greeks got pretty close. And so that what this prescription is, for the sake of the Jews, who would be outraged by the Gentiles who are willing to marry their cousins and that kind of thing, instead of, don't outrage them with that. Respect their scruples and their sentiments in that regard. That seems to make the most sense. So Paul is in the middle of this, fulfilling this Nazirite vow for these four men, and we get to the next section. When the 7 days were almost over, the Jews from Asia, upon seeing him in the temple, began to stir up all the crowd and laid hands on him, crying out, "Men of Israel, come to our aid. This is the man who preaches to all men everywhere against our people and the law and this place. And besides, he has even brought Greeks into the temple and has defiled this holy place." For they had previously seen Trophimus, the Ephesian, in the city with him, and they supposed that Paul had brought him into the temple. Presumably you know that Jerusalem was a place that just swelled in population, sometimes doubling and more in population, during the great feast days, because there would be pilgrims coming from all over the Roman Empire to Jerusalem to observe the feast as a religious obligation. The rabbinic view of the time was that every, might have only pertained to males, but every male Jew, at least once in his lifetime, was required by law, the traditions of the rabbis, was required to go to Jerusalem on a pilgrimage at least once in his lifetime to participate in one festival. You were not a Jew in good standing if you failed to do that. So there was a great deal of traffic between Jerusalem and all the other parts of the Roman empires as Jews would make a pilgrimage to Jerusalem to keep the festival. That's why we have Jews from Asia here in the temple. They are pilgrims who've come to, much like the Muslims do to Mecca, they're Jews who've come to Jerusalem to perform some religious service to God. Well, they recognize Trophimus from Ephesus. If they're from Asia, probably they're from Ephesus, or at least have spent some time in Ephesus, because that's the center of Asia. And they recognize Trophimus, and recognizing Trophimus, they make, having seen Trophimus simply in the city of Jerusalem with Paul, they assume, seeing Paul in the temple, that Paul has also brought Trophimus into the temple. Well, that's not true. He hasn't. But they jump to conclusions, and they cry out that he this is the one who teaches against this place, this temple, our religion, our faith, and he's defiled the temple by bringing a Gentile into it. There are two plaques that have been found that are in museums somewhere in the world that say no Gentile is to pass beyond this point at pains of death. You will be immediately killed if you pass beyond this point. The temple in Jerusalem is built on the arm of a larger mountain that comes, sort of a spur of a mountain that comes out, sticks out between two, at the time, deep valleys. To the west was the Tyropenean Valley, and then the Valley of the Kidron to the east. And the spur of the mountain just sort of gradually descends to the point, the low point where the valleys meet. And then there's this kind of high point up on that spur that usually gets described as Mount Zion. And the temple was just perched there on Mount Zion. There was the city ran down below it, down into the valleys, and went to the west, and eventually to the north as well, but probably at this time it was mostly to the west and to the south. What was I going to talk? Why was I getting into that? Oh, okay. So it was and it was built to be a fortress. I mean, the reason it was located there in part is because it was a very militarily strategic place. And it was basically a walled fortress, this huge space with vast walls surrounding this whole, encompassing this whole thing. Well, Gentiles were perfectly welcome to be inside the fortress part. But inside this large area, a large flat area that was a fortress, was the temple. And the temple had gates moving into inner courts, and then more gates moving into more inner courts, and then more gates into more inner courts, until finally you have this tall, fairly tall cube-like building that was the holy place, the Holy of Holies. And the deeper you got into the architecture of this thing, the more restrictions there were on who could go there. I mean, it finally got to a point where only Levites and priests could be in there, and your typical non-priests couldn't go in there. And even there, the only people who could be there and see the priests operating were men. The women were relegated to little corner rooms, courts, where they could, I don't even know if they could see from where they were, but they were relegated to sort of corners. And then outside of that, any Jew could go, but no Gentile could go. And they had this low, probably 3 foot high fence with trellis work surrounding the entire building, with gates through it at various points, and these signs on it telling the Gentiles that we'll kill you if you step foot through here. Even if you were a Roman citizen, the Roman governor in Judah had given the permission to the Jews to kill anyone, including a Roman citizen, who set foot inside those gates. They took this very seriously. So it's understandable, given that it was a capital offense for a Gentile to be inside this fence. They were utterly outraged at the prospect that Paul had deliberately and intentionally brought a Gentile inside. Okay, so then all the city was provoked, and the people rushed together, and taking hold of Paul, they dragged him out of the temple, and immediately the doors were shut. While they were seeking to kill him, a report came up to the commander of the Roman cohort that all Jerusalem was in confusion. And at once he took along some soldiers and centurions and ran down to them. And when they saw the commander and the soldiers, they stopped beating Paul. Then the commander came up and took hold of him and ordered him to be bound with two chains. And he began asking who he was and what he had done. But among the crowd, some were shouting one thing and some another, and when he could not find out the facts because of the uproar, he ordered him to be brought into the barracks. When he got to the stairs, he was carried by the soldiers because of the violence of the mob, for the multitude of the people kept following them, shouting, "Away with him." In the Temple Mount is the sort of flat spot on the spur of the mountain that the temple and all of its buildings and accompanying porches and colonnades are located. On the northwest corner, across a moat from the temple itself, the temple mount itself, was this tall tower called the Tower of Antonia. It was built by one of the Herods, probably at some point, but it had been taken over by the Romans and had been turned into both a temporary palace for the governor when he came to Jerusalem. Typically, the center of government of Judea was not Jerusalem; it was Caesarea, where Paul's going to eventually go. But he would occasionally come to Jerusalem to attend to matters in Jerusalem, and that would have been served as his palace. It was also the place where an army was stationed. That's why we have it called the barracks here. They would station an army, which would be greatly reinforced during any festival time. So this was a fairly significantly sized army that was barracked in this big tall tower. The tower went tall enough, and in fact, one of the spurs of the tower went higher, 20 feet higher than the others, so that they could look down into the temple and see what was going on in the temple. So as this riot breaks out, whoever's on guard duty there says, uh-oh, and sends a message to the commander, and the commander gets his troops, and they come marching down these stairs, and it was much higher, so there would have been a number of stairs that you come down to get into the actual temple area proper. They rush in, the people stop beating Paul, they've been beating on Paul consistently as they drag him out into the, out of the temple itself. They stop beating him, they take him into captivity, put him in chains, and try to figure out what's going on here. And the commander can't get a straight story from the crowd that's just yelling and shouting all kinds of different things, so he decides to find out from him and take him up into the barracks. As Paul was about to be brought into the barracks, he said to the commander, "May I say something to you?" And presumably he said it in Greek. And he said, "Do you know Greek? Then you are not the Egyptian who some time ago stirred up a revolt and led the 4,000 men of the assassins out into the wilderness." Sounds like a musical, doesn't it? "Oh, you're not the Egyptian who..." And then tells the whole story. "But Paul said, 'I am a Jew of Tarsus in Cilicia, a citizen of no insignificant city, and I beg you, allow me to speak to the people.' When he had given him permission, Paul, standing on the stairs, motioned to the people with his hand, and when there was a great hush, he spoke to them in the Hebrew dialect, saying..." And we'll look at what he says in a second. Josephus tells him, okay, he speaks to him in Greek, and that immediately gets the commander's attention because... he recognizes that he's not a Palestinian, he's a Hellenistic Jew, and somehow that tips him off, well, if you're a Hellenistic Jew, then you can't be the Egyptian. Now, who's this Egyptian? Josephus tells a story about an Egyptian Jew who led a group of the, what are called the Sicarii. He translates it, the assassins. They are the Sicarii. The Sicarii were the Al-Qaeda of that day in Palestine. They were vicious, bloodthirsty, cruel terrorists who got their name from a Latin word for a dagger. And I guess it's a sicarii, right? This was called, that would be plural, so whatever the singular of sicarii would be. This dagger that went by the name of Sicarius or something like that, that they would hide in their cloak. They would disappear into a crowd in Jerusalem, and would knife to death their target and then disappear back into the crowd and be gone. And they were so known for assassination in that way that they took their name from the weapon of that assassination. Their target were either Roman officials, if they could get at them, or Jews who were collaborators with the Romans. So that was the terror of this thing, is that they were trying to strike fear in the heart of any Jew. Don't you dare cooperate with the Romans. Don't you dare have anything to do with them, because if you do, you may be the target of our knife. And some scholars believe that it was probably the Sicarii who ended at Masada in 70 AD, in that battle, that bitter battle at Masada. They were an organized group of extreme zealots. The other word for the resistance in Rome were the zealots, but the Sicarii were the extremely violent end of zealotry in Palestine. Well, one of them evidently had led a kind of revolt, and it was well known that this guy who led the revolt brought the Roman army against them and then just sort of skipped out. He escaped with his life, but this guy says 4,000 of the assassins were slaughtered by the Roman procurator in the desert. This guy was not very well liked after that, having got 4,000 of these people killed, and he himself didn't have the courage to die with them. He was very unpopular. So the commander has just sort of jumped to the conclusion, oh, it must be him. I mean, he must have been so notoriously unpopular that a riot breaks out where they're beating somebody, and he just assumes, well, that's who it is. So when he finds out, he speaks Greek as a Hellenistic Greek, Hellenistic Jew, he realizes, well, that's not who it is. So he allows him to address the crowd from the steps overlooking the temple. He speaks to them in the Hebrew dialect, which actually we know would have been Aramaic, because the Hebrews at this time don't speak Hebrew language. They speak Aramaic, which is a close relative to Hebrew. It's close enough. I don't know if it's as close as Portuguese is to Spanish, but you know, kind of in that ballpark. So he's speaking to them in Aramaic. When they hear him speak in Aramaic, they quiet down. They listen. And here's what he starts to say to them. Brethren and fathers, hear my defense, which I now offer to you. And when they heard that he was addressing them in the Hebrew dialect, they became even more quiet. And he said, I am a Jew, born in Tarsus of Cilicia, brought up in this city, educated under Gamaliel, strictly according to the law of our fathers, being zealous for God, just as you all are today. He was born in Tarsus, which, as you will recall, is in modern Turkey, the southern side of the coast of southern Turkey. But he says he was brought up in Jerusalem. We don't know that much about the early childhood of Paul, and this is as close as we're going to get to some of the information. But he was brought up in Jerusalem. We're going to meet a little later in this account a nephew of Paul here in Jerusalem. So it may very well be that although he was born in Tarsus, and that was enough to give him Roman citizenship, as we'll talk about in a little bit, that maybe his family moved to Jerusalem. Or if his family didn't move to Jerusalem, maybe he was orphaned and he was brought up by his sister, perhaps. By his aunt or uncle in Jerusalem. However it came about, whyever it happened, he actually grew up in Jerusalem. So he's no stranger to the climate and culture of Palestinian Judaism. He's very, very immersed in it. He was educated under Gamaliel. Gamaliel was probably the most notable rabbi of his time. So Paul's credentials as a Jew are pretty amazing. To be a Pharisee who was trained by the Pharisaical rabbi Gamaliel, was a disciple of Gamaliel, and learned the law from Gamaliel is a big deal. I mean, it's like, you know, being Harvard educated or something like that in Judaism. I persecuted this way to the death, binding and putting both men and women into prisons, and also the high priest and all the council of the elders that can testify. From them I also received letters to the brethren and started off for Damascus in order to bring even those who were there to Jerusalem as prisoners to be punished. Yeah. But it happened that as I was on my way approaching Damascus about noontime, a very bright light suddenly flashed from heaven all around me. And I fell to the ground and heard a voice saying to me, Saul, Saul, why are you persecuting me? And I answered, Who are you, Lord? And he said to me, I am Jesus the Nazarene, whom you are persecuting. And those who were with me saw the light, to be sure, but did not understand the voice of the one who was speaking to me. And I said, What shall I do, Lord? And the Lord said to me, Get up and go on into Damascus, and there you will be told of all that has been appointed for you to do. But since I could not see because of the brightness of that light, I was led by the hand by those who were with me and came into Damascus. A certain Ananias, a man who was devout by the standard of the law and well spoken of by all the Jews who lived there, came to me and standing near said to me, Brother Saul, receive your sight. And at that very time I looked up at him. And he said, The God of our fathers has appointed you to know his will and to see the righteous one and to hear an utterance from his mouth. For you will be a witness for him to all men of what you have seen and heard. Now why do you delay? Get up and be baptized and wash away your sins, calling on his name. It happened when I returned to Jerusalem and was praying in the temple that I fell into a trance, and I saw him saying to me, Make haste and get out of Jerusalem quickly, because they will not accept your testimony about me. And I said, Lord, they themselves understand that in one synagogue after another I used to imprison and to beat those who believed in you. And when the blood of your witness Stephen was being shed, I also was standing by approving and watching out for the coats of those who were slain him. And he said to me, Go, for I will send you far away to the Gentiles. I'll stop there. Paul simply recounts to them the story, his autobiography. And it seems to me that that one of the purposes and the main function, at least of this part of his address to them, was to impress upon them his identification with Judaism, his sympathy with Judaism, his credentials within Judaism, that he is not, as the rumor has it, he is not an enemy of Judaism at all. He's a really big fan of Judaism and has been his whole life. And his newfound mission as an apostle and a servant of Jesus is not in Paul's mind the least bit contrary to that. It's completely consistent with that. Well, that's the message that he wants to convey. And he chooses to pick up on points that would make that point. He mentions how devout Ananias was before the law. You know, this wasn't a rebel. This wasn't somebody who was looking for an alternate religion, looking for a way out of obedience to the law. This was a man who strictly observed the law. And he's the one that Jesus sent to me to give me the message about what Jesus had in store for me. All along the line, there's just these little clues that connect him with a respect for Judaism. There are a couple of things that we learn here that we didn't know from earlier accounts, and one thing that strikes scholars as problematic. The problematic thing is in verse 9, "And those who are with me saw the light to be sure, but did not understand the voice of the one who was speaking to me." In the account earlier in Acts where his road to Damascus trip is being recounted, it actually says that those with Paul heard the voice, but they could not see who he was speaking to, or could not see anything, I think is how it says. This one says they did not hear the voice of the one who was speaking. They've translated it "understand" in my text, but it's actually the same Greek word. They did not hear the voice of the one who was speaking to me. And so the problem or the question is, well, is that a contradiction? Do they not have their story straight? What's going on here? Seems to me that there's two very plausible options. One is the word "hear," just as it is in English, is actually ambiguous. If you're sitting across the room from me, and as is common these days for me, you say something to me, I may say, "I'm sorry, I didn't hear you." Now, I did hear you enough to know that I didn't know what you were saying. So I heard something. I mean, I heard a voice, but I didn't catch I didn't catch the content. It was not discernible to me what was being said. And we use the word "hear" to describe that. We don't say, "I didn't understand you." We say, "I didn't hear you." Greek is the same way. I mean, they use "hear" in the same way, where what you mean by "hear" is, I didn't grasp the content of what you were saying to me. I'm inclined to think that that's probably right, and that's what my translation has done with that. The other possibility, of course, is that what they heard in the earlier account in Acts was Paul speaking to someone. They heard him speaking. They heard his voice, but they looked to see who it was he was talking to, and they couldn't see anything. That would make sense, I think, in that context there, but I think all in all, if I were betting, I would bet that what's going on is that they did hear something, a noise registered, but they couldn't understand what the voice was saying to Paul. Paul heard it and understood it, but they did not. And that's the part that is being captured here. We have a fuller account of what Ananias said to Paul in this recounting of it than we did earlier in Acts. In Acts, Ananias is pretty brief. Is described as being pretty brief and not a lot of content. We have Ananias filling Paul in some more on what God has told him here. And one of the things is interesting, that you will see the righteous one. The righteous one is a phrase out of Isaiah referring to the Messiah. And Ananias says that God has told me that you, Paul, will see the righteous one and hear an utterance from his mouth, which I believe is the only time in Acts that we hear of that promise to Paul. From Paul's letters, we recognize that's what Paul says happened, that he actually received teaching from the mouth of Jesus somehow, somewhere, someplace, that he saw the righteous one and the righteous one taught him and instructed him. Well, Ananias here is saying that God told him that that was the promise to Paul. We've already looked at this. I brought us here in connection with the earlier account, but this is the first we learn of Paul's vision in the temple. And that's very revealing of, as I think I already mentioned years ago, is really revealing about what's going on in Paul's life here, because Jesus comes to him and says, get out of the city, get out of here. They don't like you. They don't want you here. Escape. And Paul says, but I'm perfect for the job. I'm just absolutely perfect for the job. I mean, everything about me makes it so that they ought to believe me if they believe anybody. And Jesus says, okay, but get out of here. They're going to kill you. And I think that was part of Paul's training, part of his humiliation. Paul needed to be humbled. And the early part of his life as a believer was a very humbling experience for Paul. Very unproductive, relatively speaking. Not much happened. He didn't have much impact. Anywhere he tried to have impact, all he did is cause a riot, not a revival. And that can be downright humiliating. Okay, they listened to him up to this statement, and then they raised their voices and said, this is the mob now. They raised their voices and said, away with such a fellow from the earth, for he should not be allowed to live. Now, why at this point? It appears that they listened to him up to this point, but now he's mentioned the Gentiles. And all he had to do is mention the Gentiles, and all of a sudden, they erupt. That's the thing that they can't tolerate. And you know, it's probably symbolic. It probably just symbolizes for them the rumor that Paul is really basically teaching that there is nothing distinctive about Judaism. We have no privileged place, which was partially true, but not entirely true and not really adequately true. But that's what it reminds them of, and that's where they react. So Paul never gets to finish his address. They listened to him up to this statement, and then they raised their voices and said, away with such a fellow from the earth, for he should not be allowed to live. And as they were crying out and throwing off their cloaks and tossing dust into the air, ooh, dust in the air, must be symbolic. The commander ordered him to be brought into the barracks, stating that he should be examined by scourging so that he might find out the reason why they were shouting against him that way. Scourging is not nice. He's been beaten by what are called lictors before. Up in Philippi, remember, he was beaten, and that's when, after a little bit of beating, he finally reveals the fact that he's a Roman citizen and scares the guy to death. You can't even beat with lictors a Roman citizen. But scourging is a whole nother level of torture. I mean, you stretch the guy out and you make hamburger out of his back. This is serious. And Paul doesn't seem to relish this, and so he lets him know earlier that he's a Roman citizen. But when they stretched him out with thongs, Paul said to the centurion who was standing by, is it lawful for you to scourge a man who is a Roman and uncondemned? Uncondemned meaning untried, basically, without a trial. When the centurion heard this, he went to the commander and told him, saying, what are you about to do? This man is a Roman. The commander came and said to him, tell me, are you a Roman? And he said, yes. The commander answered, I acquired this citizenship with a large sum of money. And Paul said, but I was actually born a citizen. Therefore, those who were about to examine him immediately let go of him, and the commander also was afraid when he found out that he was a Roman, and because he had put him in chains. The very fact that he had put him in chains would have violated his rights as a Roman. Now, this is confusing to us who didn't live at the time. You've got this Roman who's not a Roman, and you've got this Jew who is a Roman. Now, how do you do that? We don't exactly know why there were a large segment of the Jews in Tarsus who were made Jews, but apparently at some point in history, they were granted citizenship. Sometimes as a part of military strategy, if the Roman general wanted to get a battle over, they had laid siege to a city and they wanted to get a battle over, they would negotiate with some of the people in the city that they were laying siege to, and basically the offer was, if you guys surrender, or if you guys give up, or if you do this, or if you do that, we will make you all Roman citizens, and we will grant you citizenship. Apparently that happened at some point, that or something like that happened at some point in the history of Tarsus, and there were a segment of maybe the whole city at the time, I don't know, but whoever that group was, it included an ancestor of Paul who was granted citizenship, a father, a grandfather class in the Roman Empire that didn't, you know, they were a slave class who didn't have very many privileges. But the Roman citizens did, and Paul had that citizenship. Oftentimes, people from the underclasses in Rome who were not citizens, you know, it was just a minority that were citizens, although one of the reasons Rome fell is that they kept granting more and more citizenship rights to more and more people, and there became so many citizens that a kind of mob rule took over, and that was one of the part of the political downfall of Rome. But at this point in time still, citizenship is relatively privileged, relatively rare, and this guy from Rome, probably from Rome, was not at first a citizen, and he only gained his citizenship by saving enough money and buying citizenship at some point in his life. And it cost him dearly. It cost him a great deal of money to become a Roman citizen. And Paul rubs it in his wounds. Says, I was born one. On the next day, wishing to know for certain why he had been accused by the Jews, he released him and ordered the chief priests and all the council to assemble, and brought Paul down and set him before them. Paul, looking intently at the council, said, "Brethren, I have lived my life with a perfectly good conscience before God up to this day." The high priest Ananias commanded those standing beside him to strike him on the mouth. Then Paul said to him, "God is going to strike you, you whitewashed wall. Do you sit to try me according to the law, and in violation of the law order me to be struck?" But the bystander said, "Do you revile God's high priest?" And Paul said, "I was not aware, brethren, that he was high priest, for it is written, 'You shall not speak evil of a ruler of your people.'" But perceiving that one group were Sadducees and the other Pharisees, Paul began crying out in the council, "Brethren, I am a Pharisee, a son of Pharisees. I am on trial for the hope and resurrection of the dead." As he said this, there occurred a dissension between the Pharisees and Sadducees, and the assembly was divided. For the Sadducees say that there is no resurrection, nor an angel, nor a spirit, but the Pharisees acknowledge them all. And there occurred a great uproar, and some of the scribes in the Pharisaic party stood up and began to argue heatedly, saying, "We find nothing wrong with this man. Suppose a spirit or an angel has spoken to him." And as a great dissension was developing, the commander was afraid Paul would be torn to pieces by them, and ordered the troops to go down and take him away from them by force and bring him into the barracks. Okay, we'll stop there. Okay, he's brought before the council, or the Sanhedrin. The Sanhedrin had a certain amount of power. Earlier in the history of Jerusalem, it had more power and more authority. The Romans kind of restricted the power that they had, but the Romans allowed the Sanhedrin to exercise a certain amount of authority and power with respect to particularly Jewish issues. They didn't have full reign there. They had to be Jewish issues that were also interesting to Rome, but they had a certain amount of authority. So the commander allows him to be seen by and tried by, in a sense, the Sanhedrin. He starts by, okay, the Sanhedrin is made up mostly, the majority of them would have been a group called the Sadducees. The Sadducees were, it's hard to define, but they were kind of the aristocratic Jews, and represented and reflected the aristocratic Jewish culture in Jerusalem. They were nobles, they were landowners, they were wealthy, they had a vested interest in things going well with Rome. I mean, their whole status and standing depended upon how things went with Rome. I mean, we see this clearly because in 70 AD, the Sadducees ceased to exist. the Pharisees lived on long past 70 AD, but the Sadducees were gone. Once Rome came in and said, we've had enough of this, destroyed the temple, destroyed the priesthood, and destroyed and took over Palestine, all the base of power, all the standing, all the status that the Sadducees had was gone, was just disappeared and evaporated and is gone to history. Phariseeism still lives on within Judaism to this day. I mean, that not by name, but its influence still lives on. So obviously they had a vested interest in keeping the peace with Rome and allowing Rome to prop them up in a position of power and authority. Well, they had the political power in their hands. They had the majority on the Sanhedrin. There were token Pharisees, a minority of Pharisees who were on the Sanhedrin, but they were overwhelmed by the vote of the Sadducees. That's why in the crucifixion of Jesus and in this thing that's happening with Paul here, at times all you have is the chief priests and the elders getting together. It's like the, you know, the smoke-filled inner room in the Jerusalem Hilton where they get together and plot their conspiracies. I mean, they're the boss in Jerusalem, the mob boss, and they dictate what happens. Everybody else is just a puppet to give some kind of outward respectability to the process, but it's really controlled by a handful of men who are powerful men. One of these is Ananias, not to be confused with the Ananias who brought the message to Paul in Damascus. Ananias was a relatively common name. This chief priest Ananias was a particularly corrupt, ruthless. He would constantly make deals with the Sicarii and the Zealots and then betray them or vice versa. He would use the Zealots to get accomplished his purposes and then turn on them and they'd be massacred. I mean, he just, nobody mattered but himself and his own position and his own power. So he's really a creep, basically. So Paul begins to make his defense and says, with a perfectly good conscience before God, I have lived my life up to this day. And Ananias commands those standing next to him to strike him on the mouth. Now, Paul responds, and his response is interesting. God is going to strike you, you whitewashed wall. Do you sit to try me according to the law, and in violation of the law order me to be struck? But the bystander said, do not revile God's high priest. And Paul said, I was not aware, brethren, that he was high priest, for it is written, you shall not speak evil of a ruler of your people. It's reminiscent of a scene in Jesus' trial as well. In both cases, I think that it's not, the way it sounds to us is not exactly right. I find it unbelievable. I find it unfathomable that Paul wouldn't have known that the man who was sitting there and who ordered the people to strike him was the high priest. I mean, if nothing else, you know, he had a different funny hat on or something. I mean, they're just, you don't be high priest and not broadcast the fact that you're high priest, especially a man like Ananias. So I just find it unbelievable that he was clueless that this, what, some stranger just ordered them to hit you on the mouth and you react? I don't think so. I think he knows good and well who Ananias thinks he is. But I think Paul's response is out of his recognition that there's really one and only one true high priest, and that's Jesus. And Ananias is a very, very poor and corrupt pretender to the throne. And he has absolutely no respect for him. Pretense is an ugly, ugly sin, is an ugly evil. And I don't think Paul has any respect for it at all. I think he's ultimately being sarcastic when he says, I was not aware, brethren, that he was high priest. I mean, what he means is, well, it's news to me that he's high priest. I think I know the high priest, and it's not Ananias. For it is written, you shall not speak evil of a ruler of your people. I think he quotes that not to apologize. Maybe he's cloaking it as an apology. I don't know. But I don't sense any real apology here. I think what he's saying is, I owe respect to a true ruler of the people of Israel. I owe them my respect. Not him. Because he's not a true ruler of the people of Israel. But to anyone who really would be, I owe respect. So Obviously, I wouldn't have said any such thing to the high priest. So I think he's just sort of sarcastically leaving it to them to draw their own conclusions. But I think it's ultimately defiant here. He's defying the pretense of this corrupt man and this pretender. And now I'll end with this and let you have a brief chance here before we go. He starts with, "I live my life with a perfectly good conscience before God up to this day." What does he mean by that? I mean, he had blood on his hands. How can he have lived his life with a perfectly good conscience before God up to this day? Well, what's confusing is, and this is confusing everywhere in the New Testament, is that we translate this word conscience, but it doesn't mean what we mean by conscience. Most of us have the Jiminy Cricket view of conscience, understanding concept of conscience, you know, the little voice that says, "Well, you don't want to lie. Don't do that. Don't lie." That feeling that we get, that voice in our head, that feeling of that guilt feeling, that badness that comes on us when we have done wrong, when we've done evil. Now, I'm not for a second discounting that as a very, very valuable and important human phenomenon. My point is, this Greek word doesn't mean that, however. I don't think that's what this Greek word is pointing to. If you remember in Romans 14 and in 1 Corinthians 10, there's a parallel passage about eating meat offered to idols. One of them, Romans, I think, talks about a man who is weak in faith, or one who is, by implication, strong in faith, but a person whose faith is weak or is not weak. That parallel passage uses this word, whose conscience is weak or whose conscience is strong. In both passages, Paul means the same thing. By faith, he doesn't mean faith, and by conscience, he doesn't mean what we mean by conscience. By faith, he means that set of convictions that we have, those beliefs that we have about what is right and what is wrong, what is good and what is evil. That's what conscience means almost always. It's that set of convictions that our understanding has come to grasp, out of which we live our lives. If that's sound, then we live according to our conscience, and our conscience is sound, which is to say, I have truly grasped reality the way it really is. I have truly come to understand life the way God would understand life. I understand morality to be what God understands morality to be, goodness to be what God understands goodness to be, and so on right down the line. I have come to understand myself the way God would understand me and would evaluate me. That I think it's a fairly comprehensive term, that my set of convictions about reality in all of its forms, if it's good, then it's accurate. I have grasped reality the way it actually is. And I think that's what he means here. I have lived my life, I have conducted myself, I have governed my life, literally, I think. I have governed my life by an entirely good conscience, by an entirely good understanding of reality. So what he's saying to him is, and this is what ticks Ananias off, Ananias thinks this is an outrageously arrogant claim by this renegade rabbi. He's making the arrogant claim that I get it. I understand. I know who God is. I know what he's up to in the world. I know what his purposes are. I know what role Jesus plays in those things. I get it. And because I get it, and because I understand reality the way that I do, my entire life has been governed by that understanding of reality. Is this arrogant? Well, no, because the truth of the matter is, Paul did have a good conscience in the sense in which he means it. Paul did get it. Paul was a wise man. Was he a wise man because he was more clever than the rest of us, or a better person than the rest of us, gooder than the rest of us? Why did he get it? It was a gift from God, and Paul understands that more than anybody understands that. That he was totally unworthy, but God had given him the gift of understanding as well as any human being apart from Jesus has ever understood, I think. That his grasp was as clear as any human being's ever has been. And he knows that. He knows that that's the case. It lines up with the scriptures. It lines up with his experience. He's received special revelation, special instruction from Jesus. God has confirmed his ministry with miracle after miracle after miracle. There's just no other way to cut it except he gets it. And he knows he gets it. So he marches into Jerusalem, not the least bit insecure, thinking, maybe I got a few things wrong, and, maybe Jesus is not such a big deal after all. I mean, there's no self-doubt here. He just knows that this is what the gospel is. So he says, I've just been doing what I've got to do because I understand reality. I have a good grasp of the truth. And Ananias just slaps him. And then all Paul has to say is one thing, and then the trial is over. I am a Pharisee, a son of the Pharisees. Remember, we were talking about the sons of Sheva? Here's this phrase, a son of a Pharisee. It doesn't mean that his father was a Pharisee necessarily. It means he's a member in good standing of a Pharisaical Harperote. He may not be in good standing any longer, but he was at one point. A Pharisee, a son of Pharisees, I am on trial for the hope of and resurrection of the dead. Because he mentions the resurrection, and now all of a sudden, the majority view of this council is that they dismiss the idea of resurrection out of hand. That's ridiculous. That's superstitious, folk religious garbage from their perspective. Only the peasants believe such superstitious stuff. But that's not true. The Pharisees were a serious intellectual movement in Judaism, and they believed in resurrection as well. Paul says, what's going on here is I'm being tried as a Pharisee who believes in a resurrection. That's what's going on here. Well, I don't think this is just a ploy, although it ends up being a wonderful ploy if you want to bring this trial to a grinding halt, because immediately there erupts this conflict between the Pharisees and Sadducees, and they get really violent about it, and the commander just takes Paul out of there and they leave. We're running out of time, so I think I'll pick it up there next week and talk a little bit more about why he said what he said and why it's not just a ploy. I think it's a serious critique of the situation on his part. I can't open it up because we're past our time. If you have some questions or comments, if they're urgent, you can talk to me now. And if you want to save them for next week, I'll try to leave plenty of time for discussion next week. So, thank you.